This audio feature is part of DNV's 14th Annual Energy Industry Insight Study. It is produced by FT Longitude in partnership with DNV.
An energy transition usually takes a generation, and we're trying to do this in 20 years. It's tough, it's doable, but it's akin to sort of putting the man on the moon.
It's a stark yet realistic outlook for the future, should the global energy transition continue at its current pace. In this audio feature, we're going to explore current issues in the energy industry as it evolves towards a low-carbon world.
The whole discussion on energy transition in a world of geopolitical conflict has put into perspective, I think, that we need to continue to develop the industry in a balanced manner, taking into account the need for energy immediately, and then also the continued need for energy, but with much lower emission profiles gradually. So handling volatility, both in terms of supply and demand, but also in variations in cash flows, something that we as large companies have weathered out, if you like.
We're also going to ask how the energy sector can capitalize on its biggest opportunities to increase momentum in the global transition to net zero.
We're building assets that last, in general, 50 years or more. So that long-term planning is a feature of transmission network businesses. And looking ahead is not new to us, but I think what's new to us is the volume and scale of change that we're seeing and the greater uncertainty in what those changes will be and how quickly they'll happen.
I'm Meg Wright, Head of Innovation at FT Longitude. Welcome to this special episode of DNV Talks Energy. So, how are energy industry professionals feeling about the year ahead? DNV's 14th Annual Energy Industry Insight Study reveals strong levels of optimism about the industry's growth trajectory, even if the pace of the transition has slowed in recent years.
Global emissions fell by 8% in 2020. If we are to reach the goal of 1.5 degrees, they have to fall by roughly 8% per year every year from now to 2050. The reason they fell in 2020 is that we crashed the global economy. We banned transport, right? Basically, told people to stay at home. We used 20 million barrels per day less oil in April 2020 than we did April the year before. So crashing the global economy is a possible way of reaching carbon budgets, but it's not a way I would recommend. I'm Eirik Valnes. I'm a Senior Vice President and Head of Global External Analysis and Chief Economist in Equinor. In our forecast, we think the world is on a path which is consistent with roughly 2.2 degree warming by 2100. And that's in a situation with a lot of geopolitical conflicts, with a lot of delays, with a much slower development than what we ideally would have seen, but at the same time with a lot of policy changes and technology changes moving in the right direction. It's a much more optimistic scenario than we saw just a few years back. But it's very far away from a 1.5 degree world.
Indeed, the energy sector continues to face compounding challenges, from record-breaking energy prices to geopolitical turmoil and ongoing market volatility. All this, of course, is underpinned by growing urgency for emissions reductions and increasing pressure from customers to meet demand in a climate-friendly way.
If we look at the energy transition over the last, let's say, the 15 years, it was regulatory driven. You know, government would put in a feed-in tariff and people build wind parks, right? You put in a feed-in tariff and people would put in solar on the rooftop. That's what drove it. But now we've gone beyond that. My name is Gerard Reed. I'm founder of Alexa Capital, which is one of the leading investment banks in the energy transition area. And I have been involved in financing, everything to do with energy for the last 20 years. I think the biggest change since the outbreak of the Ukrainian-Russian hostilities is that the customer now is saying, I want change. And I'm going to make change happen myself, despite what my neighbor does, despite what the grid operator does, but despite what the government does. And they can do this because the costs of these technologies are just so low.
As Gerard explains, for renewables companies in particular, these factors are contributing to a volatile market landscape, one that has led to a drop in both share prices and levels of optimism among some of the sector's biggest actors. To understand this, he says we must consider the different parts of the entire supply chain.
So if we look at the manufacturers, whether you're solar, wind or batteries, what you're doing is, and it's been going on for years, it's been a very difficult place to invest. And the reason is because it goes through cycles. What you have is a boom in, say, solar production, and then prices collapse. Wind turbines, what you see is, let's say, resistance in a particular market to the build out of wind turbines. And guess what? Suddenly you've got overcapacity in the market, prices go down. Then you've got, let's say, the Ukrainian crisis hits. Guess what? Steel prices go up, copper prices go up, and anyone supplying offshore wind turbines in trouble, right? In the battery space, what you saw was last year, 2022-23, what you saw was battery prices increasing year on year. Well, guess what? This year they're going down. And you're also looking at global markets where there's different levels of acceleration, deacceleration, and penetration. And that makes it very, very, very difficult. So I think, like, being a hardware manufacturer in all these areas, very difficult.
And there are yet more difficulties for those tasked with expanding and transforming energy infrastructure.
What we hear about and see is the challenges of delivering a large amount of infrastructure in what is a relatively very short period of time. You won't be surprised. The challenges include the amount of skilled labour, the supply chains for the materials, the planning and environmental approvals that are needed.
Meet Jackie Bridge, Executive General Manager for Energy Futures at Powerlink Queensland. As the owner and operator of the electricity transmission network in the northeastern Australian state, Powerlink Queensland shares many challenges with transmission operators around the world. And while organisations across the sector are no stranger to many of these concerns, it's the pace of change that is forcing energy companies to rethink their current and future plans, as Jackie explains.
We've got a few different challenges and future objectives. So the first one is decarbonising the economy in Australia, and specifically for us in Queensland. The second one is there is already a demand for exports of renewable energy, and the form that renewable energy might be exported in could be quite wide-ranging. Hydrogen is getting a lot of commentary, but there's also lots of talk about embedding renewable energy in processed minerals or other products, so that we basically got a domestic and an export challenge to meet. And I think, again, we'll see there are probably some competing priorities there. At the same time, the load in Queensland, we've already got a certain level of load. Then we've got many industries that are electrifying in order to decarbonise. And then we've got new loads as well, which could be feeding export renewables. And this is where the uncertainty comes in as to how quickly some of those new energy users will eventuate, and also the location where they will be as well.
While the energy industry is facing a number of challenges on the road to decarbonising, not all are cause for concern. What then does this mean for the sector's priorities in the year ahead as organisations look to gain momentum and harness a growing sense of urgency? Here's Equinor's Eric Werenis again.
This whole energy transition challenge, if you like, is something that will require effort, investments, ideas, technology development from across a very large set of actors. The ones that provide the infrastructure or supply services is the owners of the resource that we're talking about, whether it's the landowner or the government or the license holder, as it were, in the oil and gas, where we have to invest. It's the companies with the capital, it's the companies with the technology. And fundamentally, it will take place in a marketplace that is then affected by normal costs, by line of sight to a market price. And in the case of external effects that we're talking about here, of course, we need massive help, if you like, from framework conditions set by governments and policymakers.
Let's take a closer look at how this outlook is shaping the industry in three key areas: business strategy and investment, policy and regulation, and stakeholder partnerships.
For a lot of the low carbon and renewables technologies, this is about building an industry. It's about building a meaningful size relative to the overall energy market. We need permits to do this, and then that's determined by governments around the world. How quickly can you do that? We need a market design or an agreement with governments in terms of how do you price these services? What guarantee have you got on the electricity price to have a line of sight to profitability? Because we can't do these projects only solely based on volume ambitions. It has to be valued.
For this reason too, data and technology are of growing importance to energy providers. In fact, DNV's Energy Industry Insights study shows that energy companies are currently prioritising investment in digitalisation. Here's Powerlink Queensland's Jackie Bridge to explain.
One of the things that we are doing in addition to the existing asset management practices is that we're working very closely with the Bureau of Meteorology and looking at the types of weather information that we will need in the future. So looking at what data requirements there might be so that both for managing our assets but also for operating the network where the generation fleet will be weather dependent. And I think forecasting for weather and a range of other things is going to become a much more critical part of operating the power system as well as planning the power system.
But at a time where pressure to decarbonise is growing, and in a market where energy supply presents a real social and economic concern, how can energy companies go about making the best investment decisions? Here's Eric Warenes again.
Once you've made a decision to make an investment, you're committed for a certain flow of capital expenditure to finish that project. I mean, that might take 3, 4, 5 years, right? Depending on what type of project it is. But our capital allocation then is, of course, determined by the opportunities that we have, the likelihood of this being profitable investments, our strategic priorities, which leads us to lean towards growing our alternative energy offering, if you like, in our case, whether that is carbon capture and storage or renewable electricity. We have rate of return requirements and break-even requirements that allow us then to choose differently between different projects. We do not expect the same, or we do not require the same rate of return for future renewable electricity investments as we do for oil and gas, partly because the risk profile of any given investment is different. And then, of course, we're opportunity constrained. For a long period, there's been too few projects to invest in renewables, which is one of the reasons why some of these auctions became very competitive as well, because there's a lot of capital available, but there's not enough projects. So you've had a competition with lower and lower subsidies, if you like.
From a policy and regulatory perspective too, energy providers must work together with governments to ensure that emissions targets are robust, demanding, and achievable, as Gerard Reid explains.
What governments have done is they set targets. They set carbon emission targets, they set renewable targets, and, which is all great. But what they do is they miss the big picture. So they go and say, okay, we're going to put in a renewable directive just to push renewables. But they don't think about the how. And the how is where the issues come about. But the problem about one how in a renewables area, if I just say I'm going to push renewables, right? That's and how we do it. We sort on that. But then you miss, what about all those coal plants that are sitting on the power system today? What do we do with them? What do we do with heavy transport? What do we do with heat? I mean, these are huge questions. And by the way, then if you want to talk about carbon emissions, then what do you do in the whole agriculture space? There's a whole pile of questions that come up. And what I see is these are all dealt with in silos. And that's not helpful. What we need to do is we need to think big picture and at a system level and a systemic level. That's how we do this. And if we don't do that, this transition is going to be very expensive and very, very bumpy.
While a systemic approach may sound like the most sensible way forward, it must account for the sheer number of stakeholders involved in managing a transition of this magnitude. In Queensland, Australia, for example, the scale of the opportunity is matched by the complexity of these relationships.
There's a very wide range of stakeholders when it comes to electricity and the power system. The expectations for engagement with stakeholders have absolutely risen, even just in the last couple of years, but certainly over the last 5 to 10 years. The scale of change is going to be impacting more people in Queensland and in other states in Australia as we need to build new infrastructure, both generation and network assets. So we've been working hard on identifying the stakeholders that we need to engage with and also on the process of engaging and explaining the why, the how, the when of what's going to happen to the power system and to the infrastructure in Queensland.
According to IEA, there's about 50 different types of technologies that have to come into place, be invented, then be scaled, and then be deployed at speed if we are to have any chance of reaching a sort of a net zero economy by 2045, or thereabouts globally.
There's no doubt that advances in digital technology are necessary for energy providers to manage their networks differently and better. So what then are the opportunities for the sector looking ahead?
The number of generators that are connected into our system is growing very, very quickly. The figures are we used to have 11 generators connected. We've now got more than 40, and we think that by the end of 2035, when a lot of our targets are, we'll have more than 100 generator connections. So that gives you an idea that there's a lot more complexity and volume in what we need to manage as we operate the power system. So looking at both the increased number of generators and the way that they will operate means that we will need to be able to make decisions that are much more complex, and we will need to make them more quickly than we probably did in the past. So various different kinds of technology and operating systems will be needed to do that.
Digital advances will be key to delivering much needed improvements in energy efficiency and storage. This could change the very shape of the industry too, as Gerard and Jackie both explain.
Low-cost power electronics, what they do is they enable us to control energy in ways that we were never able to before. You're not increasing the size of the battery, you're just improving the efficiencies in and around how that electricity moves. Now, that's very interesting because if I take the case of a combustion engine, there's nothing really changed in a combustion engine in 100 years. We've put a little bit of power electronics, you hybridize it a little bit and you improve it that way. That's about it. But if you go pure electricity, you can also see that there are significant improvements possible in and around that. And that's an area that none of us are thinking about, but I think this is going to have significant impact.
The role of the transmission network will change. We talk about it having been a one-way flow from generators to customers in the past, but with storage assets in the system, energy will actually be doing a loop effectively. So when there's excess energy, it'll travel to the storage and it'll then have to travel back to the load. So the transmission network will be doing some quite different functions in the future.
Further afield too, opportunities abound in new and emerging markets as the growing need for sustainable energy supply remains unmet. As Arik explains, this opportunity is perhaps one of the greatest paradoxes currently facing renewables providers.
So much of what we are seeing in terms of renewable energy development takes place in the parts of the world where we have enough energy and where we're replacing existing sources of fossil fuels. You don't see a lot of offshore wind or onshore wind, for that matter, in large parts of Africa where they don't have electricity today. And how do we finance that? How do we overcome risk concerns, ownership issues, fairness issues? Who owns those types of assets?
As the outlook on regulation and investment continues to shift, consumers will also be looking for the biggest opportunities to capitalize on the transition.
The customer is taking this energy transition in their own hands where it wasn't before. And I don't think that's going to change because we built an energy system in Europe, which is high cost, right? So the only answer to high cost is low cost, because again, the economics of it makes sense. But secondly, from a regulatory point of view, they're also being pushed to do this as well. So there's also a regulatory push, which is pushing the consumer now to change their behavior, right? That wasn't there before, I'd say.
Despite a slowing in pace, it's clear that the outlook among energy industry leaders remains optimistic for the future. The challenge now will be for the industry to rise to meet the transition with the scale and urgency that's required.
There's a lot of talk about just energy transition. I haven't seen any 1.5-degree scenario that reduces the difference in income per capita between the poorest countries in the world and the richest countries in the world. I don't think it's possible to stay within the 1.5-degree scenario and achieve that at the same time.
I've recently been to the Energy Networks Association conference, and one of the keynote speakers there made an analogy between food storage and the advent of refrigeration, allowing for that seasonal food production to be stored using refrigeration. And I think we're at that transition point. It's quite a good analogy for electricity, where we'll have an abundance at times, and it'll be seasonal as well as, you know, varying from day to day, and an ability to store that in large quantities is going to be necessary.
I think we're at the beginning of an energy revolution, and the energy revolution is a technology revolution. Obviously, we've electrified a large part of our buildings over the last 100 years as it is, but if you look going forward, what we're going to do is we're going to electrify transport and we're going to electrify heat. And actually, we're going to do that in a clean way. We're going to use low-cost renewables and other forms of clean energy, combined with, I would say, real-time power controls. And that's the revolution.
I'm Meg Wright. Thanks for listening.
This audio feature is part of DNV's 14th Annual Energy Industry Insight Study. It is produced by FT Longitude in partnership with DNV.